Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today I'm joined by theatre critic for the International New York Times and good friend of Monocle, Matt Wolfe. On the bill, we have a trio of classics back on stage in London this month, including musical High Society, Arthur Miller's Pulitzer Prize-winning Death of a Salesman, and Mike Leigh's take on Gilbert and Sullivan's opera Pirates of Penzance. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. We are going to begin today's programme at the Old Vic, where High Society is showing. The musical premiered in 1997 on Broadway and is based on Philip Barry's classic stage comedy, The Philadelphia Story. For those who aren't familiar, perhaps, with that celebrated story, Matt, let's fill them in with the details. Remind us of sort of the genesis, if you will, of this.
Sure. Well, essentially, it's about a very kind of swelligant, to co-opt a word from the show, a swelligant American socialite called Tracy Lord, who basically is fought over by three guys. And what woman wouldn't want that, right? And it's based on a time-honored American play called The Philadelphia Story, which is very famous on college campuses across America for the Katharine Hepburn film version. And Katharine Hepburn is a heroine of sorts because of that.
And tell us, you know, there is always a question, I guess, with, you know, revivals or reimaginings or call them what you will, about, you know, a pressure incumbent on the performers and everyone who's displaying their stagecraft, directors, like to you know, be seen to sort of live up to what's gone before. Are you surprised by how frequently people are willing to, you know, throw down that gauntlet and go for it?
Well, that happens all the time. I mean, you know, when we talk about Death of a Salesman, one of the things there, all the other people over the years who played Willie Loman, I think the thing with High Society is you have the pressure not only of The Philadelphia Story, the movie, but there's also the pressure, of course, of High Society, the movie, which was the musical version of the play, which had Grace Kelly, Bing Crosby, and Frank Sinatra, not exactly chopped liver.
I was going to say, small shoes to fill. So how do they do then? Let's get stuck into it.
Well, what's really nice about this production, Tom, and I'm showing my age here, I've seen this show four different times. The last one had Jerry Hall in it, which we won't dwell on. But this production has a cast of people, really none of whom you would expect to find in a musical. There are a lot of classical theater performers, and guess what? They're all really, really good. And what they do is sing very well, but they also act the piece incredibly well, so that you feel, for instance, that Tracy Lord, as played by Kate Fleetwood here, is somebody whose fate we should be worried about. She's not just a sort of shallow woman who's full of airs and caprice. She's actually somebody slightly damaged. She's got an adulterous father. She's a bit of a brittle ice maiden waiting to melt. And so her thawing, which is what the show is really about, it's about her discovering that she has a heart, is actually very affecting. And without giving too much away, one of her suitors is a previous paramour of hers called C.K. Dexter Haven. I love these names. And he was a total drunk and a bit of a gadfly. And he comes back reformed. So the question is, will true love, to quote one of the song titles, prevail? I couldn't possibly answer that.
Now, Matt, I know a couple of critics have suggested some, I don't know, constructive criticism about some of the American accents that are on display in this. Was that something that you noticed? Did that trouble you, or could you overlook, if there were any deficiencies, you could overlook them?
I've heard a lot worse, Tom. I think what I, as an American based in London for many years, what I kind of dread are those performances where the performer is playing the accent, not the character. Mm. And you don't really have that here. There are a few moments where the accents are a little over emphatic, but by and large are very good. Rupert Young, an actor who I guess is known to most people nowadays from Merlin, is particularly sort of to the manner, M-A-N-N-E-R, and the manner, M-A-N-O-R, born, because he just seems absolutely right as a sort of societal chap, sort of swanning himself by swimming pools, waiting for the main chance. He's really very good.
Now, I can't quite remember, but in High Society, isn't there a dog? Does a dog feature in High Society, an elegant terrier of sorts? Is there one in the stage version, or is there no dogs appearing?
No, there are a lot of dogs on the London stage at the moment. There are a couple.
It's one of the things I always look out for.
Yeah, I think you should. And then, of course, if we don't like a show, we often describe it as a dog or a turkey. Lots of animals get pressed into service for shows we don't like. Anyone who wants to see dogs can hurry to the audience or the Curiousness of the Dog in the Nighttime. They probably trade dogs at those two shows.
Exactly. So that's High Society, which is on at the Old Vic until mm-hmm. the 22nd of August. Let's move on. You've mentioned already, and I'm sort of looking forward to talking about this, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, which is on at the Noel Coward Theatre here in London. This production's directed by Gregory Duran, stars Anthony Scher, no less, as the protagonist, Willie Loman. Now, that's a good place to start, Matt, because you mentioned, you know, look at the, in the sort of canon of, you know, yeah. 20th and 21st century performances, so many great Willie Lomans down the years. Anthony Scher pitches his hat squarely in. How does he
well,
fare?
And again, showing my age yet again, but I've seen Dustin Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Brian Dennehy. I've seen a lot of good people play this part. And Anthony Scher more than holds his own with them. I wouldn't say he's better, because they were all very, very good in different ways, but he absolutely holds his own. And perhaps the fact that he holds his own is especially surprising for several reasons. One is that Anthony Scher can be a very showy actor, a fine actor, but a very showy one. And what you want with Willie Loman, there's a bit of the showman to him. He's got the gift of the gab. He puts on a sort of false display of bravado for his wife, Linda. He's forever kind of on the rough and tumble with at least one of his sons, Biff. But you have to feel beneath all the bluff and bluster is the mind of somebody in meltdown. So you have to have an interiority to the character. And he absolutely suggests that. The other thing is that born in South Africa, although based for many, many years in England, he has done very few American parts. And I wouldn't have thought up until, you know, a couple of months ago when this first opened in Stratford, that Willie Loman was within even his orbit. It just didn't seem like the kinds of things that he does. He seems to prefer flashier, maybe grabbier Shakespeare roles like Falstaff, who he played to great success last year.
Well,
this
kind of
Ford
real
plays.
Exuberance.
Yeah. And, yeah. Where you can be sort of larger than life. The thing about Willie Loman, the tragedy of Willie Loman actually is that he's smaller than life. And that's why, not to give too much away, but he meets a grievous end, which I assume pretty much everyone knows. He's really wonderful from the very first moment you see him. The play has a famous opening where Willie Loman is walking back towards the Brooklyn home that he keeps with his wife and sons. And he's carrying his valises from, you know, another journey on the road as the salesman of the title. And really, a life of defeat is etched into the walk that he makes just from our first sight of him on stage to the front door of his home. Harriet Walter, who plays opposite him as Linda, his sort of long-suffering, very protective wife, who has one of the most famous lines in all of literature where she says, you know, attention, attention must be paid to the man. She seems, again, a rather unlikely choice. She's often playing somebody very patrician, very elegant, very regal. I mean, she's played the Queen Elizabeth I on stage before in London and Broadway. But actually, she's really wonderful. She seems to draw into herself, much like Tony Scher. And you get this rending sense of a marriage where the wife is sort of destroyed by her husband's failure to face facts, but in a funny way, ennobled by him. I mean, she will go to her grave defending her husband.
Mm. Now, people saying about Anthony Scher, and you touched upon this already, that this is, you know, the performance of his career, you know, yeah. Praise at that sort of level. As you mentioned, maybe, you know, you can't say that it's a better performance than your Dustin Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and so on. But is it that sort of thing? Is it a performance to almost remember Anthony Scher by, do we think?
The funny thing is, it feels career defining to me, but I wonder if it does to him. The only reason I question that is that he's just come out with a very good book, just to plug his book, which is about his experience for the RSC playing Falstaff. It's called The Year of the Fat Knight. And I might have thought that he was going to do maybe a similar book about playing Willie Loman, who one might think is even more of a kind of stretch, more of a reach, but I gather he has no interest in that. I wonder if for him this was an experiment that he took in conjunction with Greg Dorn, who also happens to be his life partner, and the experiment has succeeded beyond the expectations of either of them. So they embarked upon it thinking, well, if it doesn't work, we can just kind of erase it. And actually, it's done better than they thought, hence the transfer from Stratford to London. I did think maybe it could go to New York, but on the other hand, a British company taking Death of a Salesman to Broadway, it's a bit close to Newcastle, no matter how good it is.
And what about the lessons in terms of, you know, you mentioned, you know, working with your partner. Some people say, you know, the greatest, some of the greatest performances on stage and screen come from that
that chemistry, whether it's a director and an actor or a leading man and a leading lady, this seems to be an endorsement, doesn't it?
There were some people who, not me, but there were some people who were grumbling in the press that the Royal Shakespeare Company should change its name to the Royal Shakespeare Company because Greg Dorn was doing so much with his husband, Anthony Scher. I guess my feeling about it is... It's really the proof is in the results that come of this. I mean, if the productions seem like vanity productions that were a waste of the time of both talented men, I would think, okay, enough already, move on or work with somebody else. But in fact, Tony Scher won the Critics Circle Award last year for his Falstaff. This is, I think, a career-defining performance. And the next thing they're moving on to do, they don't exactly give themselves a break, Tom. The next thing they're moving on to do is just a little play called King Lear.
I think I recall hearing something like that before.
So what do you do after Willy Loman, who plumbs the depths, you scale the heights of King Lear?
That's Death of a Salesman, which is on at the Noel Coward Theatre until 18th of July. Let's finish at the opera, shall we, Matt? For Mike Leigh's co-production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance, performed by the ENO, Mike Leigh's first venture into directing opera operetta. One imagines a fairly different experience to filmmaking. How does he fare?
Well... less successfully, in my view, than the other two productions that we've talked about. It's interesting. A lot of people have said, oh, Mike Leigh directing the parts of Penzance for ENO, what a natural fit. And they say that because, and they're right about this, Mike Leigh did make a very fine film about Gilbert and Sullivan a while back with Jim Broadbent and Leslie Manville called Topsy Turvy, which is an absolutely wonderful film about the creative process involved in putting on the Mikado. But a very fine film about the artistic process is very different from staging a production of that artist's work. And the thing about Mike Leigh's terrain, whether on screen or on stage, is that he's kind of the pundit of grief or domestic distress or betrayal or misfortune. He's not a happy bunny as a creator, which has resulted in some absolutely remarkable, remarkable stuff. I'm a great fan of his work. But the thing about Pirates of Penzance as a piece, and it's a piece I like a lot, is it really doesn't have a whole lot of depth. I mean, it's satiric, but the satire is relatively shallow. It's not about grief or pain, in my view anyway. What it has to be is a romp, a lark. It has to be jolly. And I would have thought that the one thing Mike Leigh doesn't really do is jolly. It's not in his arsenal of adjectives. As a result, the production to me feels like a mismatch. And because he's never done this kind of thing on stage before, and making a movie about them isn't the same as doing their work, he doesn't really seem to know what to do with it. So it's all very sort of four square. It's very conventional. A lot of the performers are cast for their singing and not for their suitability to the actual parts. So the young sort of male lead, who we're told repeatedly in the libretto is a thing of beauty, we're told that about 10 times, is performed by somebody who, shall we say, is perhaps not that. And it just doesn't seem like anyone is very at home with it. The set by Alison Chitty isn't so much abstract as just cheap. It looks like something that was come up with at the last minute when perhaps the budget had been slashed. However, there's always a however, there is one really, really wonderful performance in this, and it's an Irish soprano I'd not heard of before called Claudia Boyle, who sings the part of Mabel, who's kind of the young soubrette, the object of a lot of the pirates' amorous affections. And she is absolute bliss. She sings like a dream. She's gorgeous, which is what the world requires. You can see why all the pirates immediately perk up when she comes into view. And when she's doing her bits, all is right with the world. When she's not doing her bits, you grin and bear it.
Bit more of a struggle. I mean, do you think that is a problem then with someone like Mike Leigh? He basically is playing this too straight. And you mentioned with the canon of his cinematic work that you can see he's a very effective exponent of that. But this requires a bit of it's a playfulness, you know, a lightness of touch, a bit of levity, which maybe, as you say, it just doesn't sit naturally. Maybe he needs some more checks and balances to bring that to
bear on the stage. I mean, this essentially is as a piece of jeu d'esprit, but also the other thing about it, which is absolutely at odds with what Mike Leigh normally does, is that what his career is based on, of course, is self-devised work, where he'll go into a play or a film, television, not knowing what it's going to be. I mean, he has an idea with Mr. Turner. Yes, he wants to make something about J.M.W. Turner, but he doesn't know how the script is going to result. He doesn't know what the scenes are going to be. He and Timothy Spall, he casts an actor, in that case, Timothy Spall, and they come up with the result. So it's all being fashioned in the doing of it. And one of the excitements of Mike Leigh's stuff is that you feel as if it's being worked out in front of your eyes. He's not done a Shakespeare play. He's not done a Chekhov play. You feel like he wouldn't want to do something where those choices were already made by someone else. So this is a rare example where he's not actually there at the fashioning of the product. So all he can do is work with what he's been given. And I don't think that's where his heart really lies. You feel as if his heart, to be honest, isn't totally with this.
Okay, so that is The Pirates of Penzance. Matt Wolfe, thanks very much for coming to talk to us about that. Before we wrap up the show, though, I just want to ask you very briefly about one other piece of sort of, musical theatre and another revival, which, well, people may have some fairly unsavoury memories of the previous incarnation of this as a musical piece, and that's Carrie.
Well, yeah, the interesting thing, Tom, is this isn't actually a revival in London, but the original production of it anywhere was at Stratford in 1988, a famously, debacle-laden production, which included the illustrious American leading lady Barbara Cook, who played Carrie's mother, almost being decapitated by the set on opening night, as a result of which she quite sensibly withdrew from the production. Then when it moved to Broadway with a different leading lady, Betty Buckley, it closed after five performances at a loss of $8 million. So there's a lot of backstory to this show. All I can say is it's a sort of strange mixture of the kitschy and the earnest, the camp and the gothic, but it is beautifully presented in this version by the two women who play the telekinetic Carrie, Sissy Spacek, apart from the film, and Piper Laurie as her religious fanatic mother, Evelyn Hoskins and Kim Criswell. And it's worth crossing London to the Southwark Playhouse just to see them. They're terrific.
And that's on through the month of May at Southwark Playhouse. Matt Wolfe, thanks very
much
as ever for joining us. This has been the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks to our producer, Holly Fisher, and researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again tomorrow for this week's book review. But for now, thanks very much for tuning in.